We have a guest, Mr. Gordon Kerr from England. How are you?
Very well, sir. How's yourself?
I'm doing good. We noticed your article, and we've been talking kind of. By the way, I'm Tom Howe. He's Dr. J. Janet Jern, you probably see him on CNBC all the time. Janet, you on CNBC Europe? You are, aren't you?
Sometimes, but I'll be on again today at 12 Central Time, Mr. Kerr. But I enjoy your work, and I think this is a great article, and we're delighted to have you on the show. So thanks for coming on,
Gordon. The thing that surprises me is, you know, we talk sort of about the same thing, and every once in a while somebody puts something together, an article where it's like all the stuff you're thinking, and somebody actually puts it down in a way where it's all there in chronological order, and you did a beautiful job. And I guess it all has to do with devaluing the currency. It comes out to be essentially a default over time, especially to the people who, you know, were owed money the way it was valued before. How is it that everybody, in your opinion, how is it that everybody has dropped into this? And what you're writing here to me is so obvious, and yet everybody in the world is racing the other way. Every economist is like, well, the other guy's doing it, I got to do it. And they're just, I mean, why is it that it seems like, I mean, you write an article like this, it's so obviously true, and yet nobody wants to hear it.
Well, it's very kind of you to say that, Tom. I think that, to quote my Cotton colleague, Detlef Schlichter, who's written a stunning book last year called Paper Money Collapse, we all get sucked into thinking paradigms. You know, I've worked as an investment banker for the bulk of my career. And, you know, there's certain things that, although they're true, if you say them in certain environments, you'll just get laughed at. The accepted narrative is that the best way for any economy or money system to run itself is to have very intelligent fellows working for the central bank, liaising closely with government, taking certain actions to help the economy get back on its feet. And really, when you look at the history of this, which is that it's now just over 40 years since President Nixon terminated the final link of our paper currency systems to anything remotely hard in August 1971, then we've had 40-odd years of constant stimulus, and really look at the mess that we're in right now.
Well, I think you are too. And the game becomes government to government, but clearly here in the U.S., we were talking about it before you came in, the people that are caught in the crosshairs are individual savers, or yeah. Even some of these clearing firms. We're talking about one that went under last night, or allegedly went under. It's breaking news. But I have a question for you, and I'd love for you to be able to answer this, because I have a little bit of an economic background, not yours or not the people that are supposedly running the place, but I don't understand how back in the Clinton era, in his first term when things weren't so hot before the economy really picked up, not saying it was his fault it picked up, but it happened while he was there. You know, it's like, you know, it's like the economy picked up while Dr. J and I walk out of the can or something. You know, it's like you don't know if it's a causal relationship or not. But how? But he basically wanted to float more money, and his advisors told him, you can't do that. The market will kill you. The interest rates will run up, and you'll it'll never happen. How have these guys been able to get away with this without interest rates running to 10 or 12%? Because, I mean, they've gone the other way. How is the market allowed them to do it? Is what flabbergasts me.
How is the market allowing currency debasement without interest rates rocketing up right now?
Right.
I think is your question, and
yes.
It's a very, very good question. Here in Europe, obviously, you being Chicago-based, rightly want to consider the American parallel. But, I mean, here in Europe, we have a situation where medium-term German yields are now very close to zero, I think 0.03% overnight, where Spanish and Italian yields are 7%. And I think maybe the reason for this is that despite the tremendous amount of resources being thrown at the problem by the European Central Bank and national central banks over here, namely they're buying government bonds with effectively printed money to suppress the ostensible interest rate, we're still seeing these large discrepancies, and 7% for Spain and Italy is a fairly large number here in Europe. In the US, obviously the US economy is enormous and really very powerful despite all the problems. And given the aggressive action by the Fed, it doesn't surprise me that rates have stayed at these low levels for this period of time, but I don't think that this solution will work. I don't think it can carry on forever. And I feel when you look at the history of attempts by governments to print money to get out of these problems in pure paper money systems, they do end in severe rising inflation. I think there have been periods, as you pointed out, the Clinton era, and, you know, certainly when Volcker came to power, when some kind of restraint was enforced maybe by rising, by allowing interest rates to rise, and that obviously reverses these perverse incentives that I think we both agree the economy is suffering from right now. Because when you debase money in this way, when you remove incomes from retirees, you get a whole bunch of unplanned consequences. We now have a massive Western pension crisis. You know, we've had the announcements here in the UK earlier this week from Steve Webb, the pensions minister, that they're going to require the pensions industry to give guarantees that people's lifetime savings don't fall below the nominal amount saved. I mean, that is relatively insane. You know, a guarantee from that sort of guarantee just cannot really work out. And I think the most politicians know that what we're discussing is essentially true, and I think their policies will be to allow, hopefully, from their perspective, gradual incipient inflation to, devalue the unfunded promises that governments have made in the forms of pensions and so forth. But that's a scant consolation to the 60, 70, even 80-year-old retirees who are relying on fixed incomes from their savings.
Yeah, I mean, this part of this article, we're talking to Gordon Kerr, folks, who wrote this article in Bloomberg, the article is basically discussing whether it's a sovereign default when you debase your currency. I'll just quote briefly here, just because I think this is such an interesting part of the article, because I'm sure that our listeners, Gordon, have no idea that there might be a £5 to 7 trillion cost of UK unfunded state pensions, and that comes to about £180,000, as in pound sterling, folks, per household in Great Britain. That's a staggering number. Even compared to our debt, that's a staggering number.
Yes.
I don't see how at some point the money's just not going to get paid. There's all kinds of, we have the same issue here, and again, I'll keep referring to ours because I think it's the same issue. And Jan, help me if I'm wrong here, but when the people in the public sector have this pension and nobody's really made any money in the last, say, 12 years in the market or in fixed income, I mean, made a little bit. So these pensions were all, if they were funded, I mean, in Chicago they weren't even funded, but if they were funded, they were funded with probably a 6 or 7 or even 8% number on them. So they were underfunded given what happened over the 12 years. Say you made 2%, you didn't make the 8. Okay, now, but the rest of the people here that have 401ks, the regular people that aren't covered by these pensions, they're essentially bleep out of luck too. But on the public side, somehow or another, people think that somehow they should be made whole. I don't see how they're ever going to be made whole by other people that have less money than when they started at all. I mean, the numbers just don't work. I mean, in Britain, is there any way that the people who don't have pensions can possibly come up with the money for all the other people thinking that they have pensions and make them whole? I don't see that happening.
No, that's an absolutely fair point, Tom. I mean, and also the point, as you say, rightly applies to the United States. A lovely little story. I was in Sofia in Bulgaria last week, teaching at the New Bulgarian University, masterclass on the banking crisis, and I met up with Stephen Hayward from the American Enterprise Institute in Washington and Alex Alexiou, both of whom have, I think they live in near Cambria in California, a lovely little town that I drove through with my wife in 2006 and stopped off for some nice bottle of wine. And Alex, who has his own little vineyard there, says that he drinks most weekends with a local 55-year-old retired head of police who's on a pension of $180,000 a year. He's saying that you've got maybe 40 years of life ahead. These public pensions have gone completely out of control. And, we see this in the UK in particular with the rise of the public sector. I think more than 50% of people in the UK derive the lion's share of their income from the state. So that includes entitlement recipients and also state employees, such as our doctors with our National Health Service and so forth. And there's just a complete failure of anybody to do the sums properly. You know, you can see how every year, every few months, there's another group of public sector workers who want some further concessions, and the easy thing for the politicians to do is simply to concede the request rather than take a stand and risk, as here in the summer in London, risk any transportation workers' strike when we have the Olympics in 3 weeks' time.
Well, that's very familiar. I mean, I can't get over them. The problems are exactly the same. Sounds like we're in Chicago, and I'm really happy you guys got the Olympics, not us, aren't you, Jen? Well, so what do you think? How does it? Is there any way we can come out of this without reaching the end of a cliff? Is there any way that can somehow or another we can start growing fast enough to put this mess back together? In your mind?
Well, at the risk of you sort of thinking that I'm one of the most crazy interviewees you've ever had, I became very concerned about this 2 years ago, and I've formed, I think, the only consultancy on earth that's actually trying to fix the banking crisis called Cobden Partners, and we signed up some of the world's leading economists and monetary specialists, chaps in Bulgaria who actually set up a currency board 14 years ago and linked their currency to, in fact, originally to the Deutschmark, now to the euro. The mechanisms exist for governments or operators of money systems to take remedial action sooner rather than later. Together with a member of parliament in the UK, Steve Baker, my team have drafted two sets of legislation in 2011 and one in February this year, both of which would seek to rectify the banking excesses within the system, because obviously banks themselves have been somewhat out of control, certainly on this side of the pond. And you've seen the scandals recently with banks admitting falsifying interest rates, creating enormous liabilities for bank shareholders. There's an integrity gap here, you know, just as central bankers issuing statements that I don't think any serious listener would accept the speaker actually believes. So, you know, that's a parallel with the role the banks have played in the crisis. And I think over here in Europe we have an accounting system called IFRS, International Financial Reporting Systems, reporting standards, and that simply leads to falsification of accounts. There needs to be some recognition by electorates that the measures being imposed at the moment are not only not going to fix the crisis, they're going to have the opposite effect. That was the title I used in a paper for the Adam Smith Institute last December, when I analysed the banking role in falsifying accounts, creating vast bubble-type balance sheets, so that when in 2008, for example, over here, we had the UK and Irish banks all collapsing, they didn't just lose their entire share capital. They lost, in one case, six times their share capital. Now, it's not possible for anybody to lose that much money in one accounting period. And the point I'm making is that the accounts were grossly inflated by highly questionable accounting practices in the periods leading up to that, as we now see being admitted to by Barclays in this libel fixing scandal.
Gordon, I have one final question for you. We'll let you go, and we reserve the right to ask you back. We talk about we were talking about this a little bit yesterday, Jan. I don't know if you agree with it or not, but I mean, we had our real estate crisis, okay, which of course was on top of other crises. But people, you know, blame giving mortgages to the wrong people and so forth. But I think that's a very sort of naive view. I mean, what happened in a lot of ways was Japan was coming up with money at 0%, and people were chasing 6% mortgage returns here, and they didn't really care what they were putting money in. What is the? I got to believe over in Europe, traders being traders, there's got to be people dying to borrow, even if it's overnight or for a week or for a month, dying to borrow money in Germany for, you know, half of 1% and lend it to Spain for 7%. And there's got to be a massive flow there, with the idea that the pressure on Merkel and the rest of these people to essentially make that trade good has to be dramatic. I mean,
and it's ridiculous, because you see hedge funds and other entities, other banks, I believe, are doing that trade as we speak. It's a nice, easy carry trade. So, you know, if you're a bankrupt European bank, then, you know, you can effectively lend money to Spain at 7%. You can take that promissory note or bond along to the European Central Bank, discount it, and raise the funding you needed to make the investment in the first place. It's a circular trade that is making this crisis worse and worse by the day. And for the central banks to allow this to carry on is a serious mistake.
How do they stop it? Well, I mean, how could they? Other, I mean, to me, it's going to stop itself in a bad way. I don't know. What do you feel, John? I don't see them ever doing it. I just think it happens wrong. It happens bad.
I mean, unfortunately, I happen to agree that they don't have the willingness to address the core problem.
Well, Gordon, what would you say? How would it start to unravel?
I think the way it will unravel, I'm afraid to say, is prophetically fairly obvious. When you reach the point, I mean, people assume Germany is an undoubted credit. It's not. Its debt to GDP is up in the 80%, and that ignores tons of money, another trillion that I think they've lent to the other European countries that's embedded in the intra-central bank settlement system, which is a rough parallel with the settlement system you have in the U.S. between your 12 regional reserve banks and the Fed. But whereas in the U.S. you have to settle those liabilities every year, you know, if you're the Reserve Bank of New York and you owe some money to the Reserve Bank of St. Louis, you have to pay that off every 12 months. In Europe, in Euroland, that just carries on growing and growing and growing. And Germany is exposed to so much liability through that their true debt to GDP is probably way over 100% right now. And the way it will unravel is this. Investors are sitting there thinking, well, because you're a big fund, you have to have your money in something. You might as well have your money in German bonds. The rate is pretty close to zero. When the rate goes to zero or slightly negative, somewhere around now, investors are going to think, well, actually, this government promise is not undoubted. I'm getting absolutely nothing in return for my money. Therefore, I might as well sell the bond, draw cash out, and store that cash in a vault rather than own it in bond format, because at least the risk of default on the paper money is, okay, paper money could collapse, but at least I've got the paper money itself as opposed to a government that may not even give me the paper money. And when that moment starts to gather momentum, then we'll find a wholesale sell-off of all government bonds, and that will be the collapse of the Western banking system here in Europe. And, I'm gambling quite a lot on the accuracy of that prediction, and we're traveling around Europe at the moment talking to as many Eurozone governments and leading opposition parties as will speak to us, and we're saying, you chaps need a plan B. And the plan B, I think, is now a function of the crisis being so bad, a terrible crisis in the banking system, combined with a crisis in sovereign debt systems, you need to have a plan B, and it probably is redesigning your currency and hardening it, linking it to gold. Because as the article points out, if Greece, for example, was simply to revive the drachma, it would get absolutely belted out of the park by Soros and so forth the first time there's any slightly bad news. Only by having a currency that's linked to a hard commodity standard will individual countries be able to withstand this sort of crisis. And of course, the euro should exist. It's a perfectly valid idea for a bunch of 27 trading nations to have a common monetary standard. But the way it's being run right now is so appalling that I have, I would never advise any fringe country, say in the Balkans, considering their next step to actually join the euro and expose themselves to this.
Well, Gordon, thank you very much. I'm sort of with you. I think that people ought to be able to have a paper currency without it being tied to something, but you're right. It doesn't look like they are able to deal with it. But anyway, we plan on having you back maybe in about a month. We'll see if somebody has found a way to make things better or it's getting worse. So we'll keep tabs, buddy. And keep writing these great articles. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gordon. Thank you.